there's a lot of right answers for how much Bitcoin you should have. But I think that if anyone who looks into it generally finds that the zero is not one of the right answers. So I think get off zero. There's some research that shows basically the more someone is knowledgeable about Bitcoin, the larger share of the net worth it ends up being. So my general view is that if there's a time where it makes sense for you to increase your holdings substantially, I'm not the one that tells you that. You're the one that figures it out for yourself. I think that's kind of one of the biggest misunderstandings in finance. The baseline inflation rate, if you have a relatively fixed money supply, is negative. And that's because, you know, there are billions of people working every year, generally to make things more productive. Unless there's a war or famine or something, we're generally more productive this year than we were last year, and especially as we were 5 or 10 years ago. Basically, the benefits of productivity growth should be giving us more. We can buy more per our unit of time, our unit of money, and that's not the case.
Welcome to Saving in Bitcoin, your financial freedom blueprint on the Bitcoin podcast, powered by Fold, the best place to buy, earn, and save in Bitcoin. I'm your host, Walker, and in this 6-episode limited series, I'm talking to some of the best minds in Bitcoin to walk you through the basics of why our money is broken, how Bitcoin fixes it, and how you can use Bitcoin as your personal financial freedom blueprint. Let's get started. Greetings and salutations. Today I am joined by Lynn Alden. Lynn is an independent investment and macroeconomic analyst, author of the incredible book Broken Money, and general partner at VC firm Ego Death Capital. Lynn, welcome. Thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me. Happy to have the discussion.
So it's hard to talk about a solution before we understand the problem. And I think that many people realize that our system, the system, is broken, but they kind of have trouble understanding why the system is broken, what's actually breaking the system. And people like you and I would say the system is broken because the money is broken. And you literally wrote the book on this, Broken Money. So we're going to talk about broken money today and how Bitcoin is basically a blueprint for individuals and families to be able to escape that broken system. And where I want to start is kind of the TLDR on why our money is broken and how we got here. How do you condense down all of the incredible information that's in your book into something that's accessible for people who don't necessarily have the time to go deep into monetary history? How is the system broken? How did we get here?
So I try to describe it as a technological problem first and foremost, but that doesn't necessarily require really deep technical understanding. There's just some key points. And so I kind of separate the financial history into kind of three main eras. So the first era was pre-telegraph. That's when everything was analog. And so there were monetary technologies, things like coinage, things like paper and the printing press. We don't really think of them as technologies today, but at the time, they certainly were these new technologies that allowed basically forms of ownership and money to move around quicker and transactions to move around quicker. But once they invented the telegraphs, that was the 1830s, and then by the 1860s, we had cross-Atlantic cables, cross-continental cables, and you could talk almost instantly or send low bandwidth signals almost instantly around the world. And that means you could do transactions almost instantly around the world. And the way that I describe the problem is that opened up a really big mismatch between transaction speeds, which could now just go around the speed of light almost, and settlement speeds, which at the time were still physical gold and other, physical valuables. And the kind of the main way that they bridged that gap was to have a big centralized ledger. So either big commercial banks or in many cases a central bank that all the commercial banks build on top of. And that becomes a trusted layer that everybody has to use to bridge between settlements and transactions. And whenever there's a really big centralized honeypot, it's prone to manipulation. It's prone to people misusing it for various reasons and kind of breaking that trust. And the reason I look at that through that technological lens, because I think for the first time in a very long time, that gap is closed. Because Bitcoin, it represents multiple things, but in this context, it represents the invention of fast settlements. So after basically a century and a half, we finally had the settlement side catch up to the transaction side. And that, of course, took a lot more bandwidth, a lot more inventions that just had to be created over the course of that period of time. And so I would say money's been broken. It's partially because of individuals making decisions. So we can point to, you know, the creation of this central bank or this politician making this decision at this time. Those are all true. But I think the structural underlying problem for why it's basically broken in every single country, and it's been broken for a very long time, is because we've kind of lived through this technological mismatch. And that's made it very hard. Basically, all the incentives in front of politicians and central bankers and policymakers in general erred toward making it very easy for them to break the trust and create problems.
I think that technological perspective is so fascinating. It's one that people don't necessarily think of. They think of, okay, this is some, entirely a human-caused problem. And while there are human components to this, of course, decisions that were made, a lot of this is sort of an inevitable path of this mismatch that you describe. And I think maybe in one of these more human-caused problems, though, if I can say that, is this idea of inflation. You know, you mentioned previously money being tied to gold, being tied to something that's a hard asset, something backing the money. A lot of people may still not realize that our money, and if we talk about the United States, hasn't been tied to gold since 1971. And they think of inflation, they hear inflation, they hear politicians talking about inflation. They may view it as something that's sort of natural. It's an inconvenience. Prices are going up, things are getting more expensive. But really, it comes down to the value of your money going down. And so I'm kind of curious, how do you define inflation that is now possible because of this broken system that we have, this unchecked system? And how does that actually impact the everyday person's ability to be able to save, plan for their future, and invest?
So structural inflation, the underlying cause, is growth in the money supply on a sustained basis. Now, you can have temporary causes of inflation, of price inflation, things like, for example, a war or a shortage or other, basically anything that harms productivity can make prices go up temporarily in a certain area. They will generally, if the money supply growth itself is not the issue, those prices will come down in time and or they will lower the prices of something else that people aren't buying because they have to prioritize buying this thing that has gone up in price, if it's something core like food or shelter. But in order to get sustained, persistent price increases like we see today and for a very long time, it requires that the money supply itself is increasing. That's an axiom that is true everywhere. And that primarily hits us in one of two ways. The way we normally think of it is consumer prices go up, or a typical basket of what a person might buy in a given year, that basket is increasing. And they're all happening at different rates. I mean, you know, things like hospital services might be going up faster than the official inflation rates, while things like electronics might actually still be deflating because they're getting more productive even faster than the money supply is growing. And so they actually have a negative inflation rate in some cases. And the mix of all that together is we find that the average price of living a year of our lives, much like last year, is higher. Which means that then Americans have to go out and try to get a raise, try to kind of keep up with that. The other way that it can manifest is it can show up in asset price inflation, which is normally not very captured in consumer prices. But basically, when you have a period of rapid money supply growth, but also pretty high productivity growth, so if the economy is doing a pretty good job of keeping, you know, energy well supplied and other goods and services flowing pretty readily, then, you know, not all of that money supply growth is going to necessarily show up in prices at the same rate. And a lot of that surplus will show up in things like equity prices, housing prices, gold going up and kind of capturing some of that, maybe the modern era Bitcoin now. But looking at history, we basically any of these more monetary type of assets that are primarily owned by the wealthier, the upper middle class and the middle class, those assets tend to capture a lot of that growth, but then that can make it harder for new entrants to want to buy those assets, which is particularly relevant for housing. So at the end of the day, it all comes back down to money supply growth, because that's a necessary part of, you know, if we see inflation like on a persistent basis, it has to be because the money supply itself is also growing.
And, you know, you mentioned this asset inflation, which I think is really not often fully understood by people. They think, again, they think inflation, they think consumer prices going up, my eggs at the grocery store, my ground beef, whatever it might be. But they often don't think about just houses. Like, houses are such a great example. You've got the boomer generation that, you know, as the joke goes, bought their house for a handful of strawberries back in the, you know, early 70s. And their house is now worth millions of dollars. And meanwhile, you've got millennials, Gen Z, even some younger Gen X who feel like they just can't ever, they won't ever be able to afford a home. Is this kind of why there's this general feeling of it's harder and harder to get ahead. I can't possibly save enough. This kind of, this realization that, okay, asset prices, which I don't own a lot of as a younger person, are just running away from me. And you're never able to kind of catch up to that. You're never able to feel that you get ahead. Is that where you think this general sense comes from? It's just this misunderstanding of the fact that that is still inflation. It's just a different kind of inflation.
Yeah, I think that's a really big factor. I think when we look at a couple key things like house price inflation, as well as other big expenses like healthcare inflation, these things have generally been above trend compared to what we think of as inflation, CPI. And those are some of the biggest expenses that people have. And so back in like the 70s, for example, interest rates were quite high. And so in many cases, you know, saving in bonds, especially by the time they got to the 80s, was considered more attractive. And you wouldn't necessarily want to go out and buy a house just for savings if you're going to pay a mortgage rate of like 10% or higher in many cases. So the average house price was lower, and people primarily looked at them as a utility thing. You need shelter, so you buy a house. As interest rates came structurally down, and as we went through multiple decades of persistent currency debasement and people realizing that if the money's weak, they have to save in other things. They have to monetize other scarcer assets if they want to preserve their purchasing power. One of the key things they go into is real estate. That's in addition to things like equities or gold or other financial assets. But real estate's obviously a very large and popular one. And so people can buy second homes and leave them empty. People can, do all sorts of things. And they're willing to pay pretty high prices because if you're wealthy and you can get a 3% mortgage, while money supply is historically growing at 7% a year, many of them will pay up quite a bit for a house and then price out more price-sensitive buyers. And so that has been a pretty persistent issue against the middle class and overall household formation and key metrics like how many hours of work it takes to afford a house. And some people will push back on that and say, well, houses have gotten bigger on average. Then the kind of the counter pushback is that they've also in many ways gotten lower quality per square foot. So if you knock on the wall of your new construction today, it's going to sound like balsa wood compared to, what a new construction would have been like years ago. And of course, you've gotten better at engineering, so some things work better, of course. But on average, it just takes more work to afford a similar size and quality of house than it did some decades ago. And therefore, it often takes two incomes, and people can feel like they're having trouble getting ahead.
I think there's also this general sense of, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And sometimes that may be, politicians will say, it's because you have these greedy billionaires or whatever it may be, whatever the statement of the day happens to be. But is there something more structural there? Is that kind of what you're getting at? That, okay, the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, yes, it's happening. But the reason for it happening is not so much individual greed. It's something that's more baked into how this system works. Stop earning dirty fiat rewards. Stack sats on everyday spending with the 2% Bitcoin Rewards credit card by Fold. Unlimited Bitcoin back on a platform purpose-built for savings. Head to the link in the show notes to get started. Buy Bitcoin, earn Bitcoin, get paid in Bitcoin. Make Fold your personal finance hub for spending dollars and stacking sats.
Yeah, I would say it's more structural. And much like a point I made earlier, it doesn't mean that human decisions aren't relevant. I mean, there are certainly countries where there's higher levels of corruption than other countries. So the problem can be more kind of exaggerated or more subtle. But overall, the main issue basically relates to the Cantillon effect. So the closer you are to the source of money creation, generally the more you benefit from this perpetually expanding money supply system. And so, for example, if you're a large bank, if you're a large corporation, if you're high up in these types of entities, or otherwise, if you're wealthy and you're able to access cheap credit for very long periods of time, you're kind of perpetually, in a self-reinforcing way, advantaged from that system. You're able to basically short fiat currency. You borrow fiat currency at a lower rate of interest than its supply growth rate. So you're shorting something that's losing its value, and you can go out and buy all sorts of financial assets, buy cash flow producing businesses, buy all sorts of things. Whereas if you're generally on the lower end of the income and wealth spectrum, it's harder for you to access credit. It's very expensive when you do get credit. And then you can, ironically, like you pay more for banking services just because you're dealing with fees and problems there. So it kind of becomes self-reinforcing to the downside, unless you can have like a big jolt, like education or something that can help you kind of break out of that. While there's always some degree of wealth concentration in any system, for a variety of different reasons, I think the kind we're more worried about is what we perceive as unfair wealth concentration. So someone invents a new widget that makes everyone's lives better. Most people they don't lose sleep over the fact that that person became quite wealthy, because sure, they got wealthy, but they made everyone else essentially wealthier too. I think where we notice the problem is, especially in the financial sector, when you kind of look and say, well, is that person really adding to society, or are they kind of they kind of put themselves in a kind of parasitic position near the core of the system, so they're able to get out disproportionate benefits from that they wouldn't have in a more sound money system. The other big factor is that if you're really close to power, and power has a flexible monetary ledger that you can really print money, then you can get selective goodies or bailouts. And so, for example, for decades, the most lucrative thing you could do was go to Wall Street, unless you're going to be Bill Gates or something and be an outlier inventor or something. The much easier path to riches was go to Wall Street, work in finance. And then eventually when that blew up, when they over-leveraged themselves and blew up, they had enough pull with the government to get themselves largely bailed out, either in terms of direct capital injection or being given very low cost of capital, artificially low, right at the time when everything's cheap and no one else has access to low cost credit. And so that combination and is basically that the rich kind of keep getting richer and finding more ways to influence politicians to help them stay rich and get richer. Whereas if you're on the wrong side of that, your influence is weaker and you're working against these things that are kind of self-sustaining against you.
So, I mean, this is the idea of, okay, if everything is, let's say, I mean, it feels kind of rigged, and maybe, again, it's not fair to say that it's completely rigged, but certainly there is a small group of people who benefit disproportionately from this system. As you identified, they're able to get access to cheaper credit than a consumer who's paying 25% for their credit card, to access that kind of credit. They're able to borrow at these extremely low rates. What eventually changes that? I mean, is there anything that actually stops that from the perspective of, how do you break out of that cycle if you are you're a wage earner, you're working hard, maybe you're forced to work multiple jobs, multiple people in your family are working multiple jobs. How do you ever possibly break out of that cycle when you don't have the same game pieces that some of these financial elites, these financial operators are able to access? Is there anything that eventually changes that tide?
So there's kind of the national answer and then the individual answer. So we start at the individual answer. Generally, it takes quite an acceleration of some sort. Either someone working super hard, getting a higher income, education, a lot of things going right. It takes some degree of luck. in a variety of ways to kind of kickstart your way out of that cycle and you know, skip a generation or so, which is not everyone can do. It's very hard. And then at the national level, the kind of the dark side of this is that if left unchecked, it can contribute to revolutions and big resets, which usually don't even, you know, not only are the people at the top that kind of, you know, metaphorically or literally lose their head, even people at the bottom often don't necessarily benefit from that reset. It kind of, sometimes it just creates more poverty for everyone, depending on how that revolution goes. There are some times in history where society is able to do kind of a partial reset, where they kind of realize they're off track and they do kind of, you know, they don't just reset the whole board, but they realize that there's some shifts needed and they start to kind of swing the pendulum the other way. But those are, it's a narrow path. It's hard to thread that needle, which is why it's worth kind of warning about even when times seem pretty good, because if over time the discontentment grows, that's the better time to try to address it rather than to let it kind of metastasize and get really bad. So historically, we go through these periods somewhat cyclically. And, you know, the challenge is, of course, you know, I kind of separate two types of debt. So if we say, you know, on one hand, it's natural that lower risk borrowers are going to have access to cheaper credit. That's not the main thing. I think that the issue is primarily around arbitrage. So if money is sound, there's very little reason to have debt for the sake of having debt. You only take out pretty high return on investment debt. Maybe you're starting a business. Maybe you're getting educated. Maybe you're you know, solving a near-term liquidity lead with an issue with a collateralized loan of some sort. But you don't just have debt for the sake of having debt. I think a key aspect of our system is that large and well-connected entities and individuals purposely maintain large amounts of debt at low interest rates because they're basically shorting fiat currency and using it to accumulate more scarce assets. There are companies that have been profitable every year for like 100 years that nonetheless have billions of dollars of debt because it's basically a fiat currency short. And same thing for individuals that don't need a 30-year mortgage, but we have one because it's on offer to us. So why wouldn't we? And so we're able to short fiat currency for 30 years and bid up the price of houses for everyone else. And I think that's the type of debt, and that's the type of kind of the structural Kantian effect that differentiates this from just a more healthy, rational risk assessment type of setting.
Can we take a one step back and also just define in layman's terms sound money versus fiat money for anyone who may be unfamiliar with this so that they understand kind of what we're talking about here when we differentiate these two forms of money that you're talking about?
So sound money generally has some degree of genuine scarcity to it. It's not just artificial scarcity. A very common example would be gold historically, that it's very energy intensive, labor intensive. To move a ton of rock to get an ounce of gold, basically, and refine all that. And so it's basically a money that no individual can just print out of thin air. Even those producing it have to put a lot into producing it. And as a result, like, we look at the history of gold supply growth, according to various estimates, generally the annual supply growth rate is something like 1-2% per year. And so the estimated above ground refined gold due to new mining and very residual losses, nets something like 1.5% growth per year. And because that's generally equal or less than our productivity growth, it means prices don't really go up, in gold terms. And if anything, a lot of the prices of things you've gotten much better at making go way down in gold terms. Whereas fiat money is basically a human-controlled ledger that a central bank or commercial banks are basically saying, here's our number of units in the system, your account has this many units, and then there are certain authorities near the center of the system that they can increase the number of units in the system. And so in developed countries, the average supply growth rate of fiat currencies is something like 6-8% per year. Now, people are getting generally more interest on things like savings accounts and things like that. So they're offsetting some of that, but their net dilution rate, like you're holding a piece of the ledger and your ledger is getting slowly diluted like a melting ice cube, generally at a faster rate than if you were holding an ounce of gold, for example. In developing countries, the average is something like 14%, and it varies wildly depending on the country. I spent part of each year in Egypt, and they've been above 20% money supply growth for annual year over year for quite a while. And so everybody who's holding Egyptian pounds is getting rapidly diluted as part of that system. And so that's fiat currency.
I appreciate the distinction. And I think it may be somewhat shocking for people to hear what you just said about even in a developed, you know, fully developed country like the United States, that you're looking at a money supply growth rate of 6, 7, 8% on average over the long haul. Because when we're told what we're told is the inflation rate, this consumer price index that is published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, typically we know the Federal Reserve targets a 2% inflation rate. That's their goal. Now, they've been above that for a while. It got up as high as, I think, 9% with that rate of change during COVID. Now it's back down to somewhere in the mid threes. How is it that there's such a discrepancy between what is being reported, what we're told inflation is, and what you've defined as this true measure of inflation, which is the money supply growth? Why the mismatch there?
The biggest reason is because the baseline is not zero. I think that's kind of one of the biggest misunderstandings in finance. The baseline inflation rate, if you have a relatively fixed money supply, is negative. And that's because, you know, there are billions of people working every year generally to make things more productive. We're, unless there's a war or famine or something, we're generally more productive this year than we were last year, and especially as we were 5 or 10 years ago. And as an example, I mean, if you remember TVs from 10, 20 years ago, you know, they were smaller, they were less clear, and now they're bigger, they're clearer, and they're you know, not really much more expensive because we've gotten radically better at electronic production, for example. And different areas of goods and services have different levels of productivity growth, or in some cases, backsliding on productivity. And as a general rule, scarcest things are really hard to get more productive on. So waterfront property, gold, labor-intensive hospital services or childcare services, things like that. Whereas things that are able to be manufactured or quickly grown, and especially anything in software, for example, a lot of that can drive down the cost because we can be very abundant in those areas. And so the big mismatch is that if you have, say, on average 3% productivity growth per year, if you had a fixed money supply, you'd expect the average price to get 3% lower per year. Now, if you then have 6 or 7% money supply growth, that's not on top of zero. That's on top of that negative 3% baseline. So you're left with 3 to 4% price growth, and the average person is looking at that and say, well, they should be not going up at all, but they're going up by 3 to 4%. Whereas the reality is they should be going down. Basically the benefits of productivity growth should be giving us more. We can buy more per our unit of time, our unit of money, and that's not the case. And one of the reasons that kind of politicians and central bankers focus on this is that taxes and spending are quite transparent in many cases. I mean, they can still have areas of opaqueness, but in general, a person knows how much taxes they're paying, and then they can try to see, am I getting those services, or like to kind of equal that or not. Inflation is kind of this invisible tax. It's like this kind of way to make the numbers meet, because politicians are always pressured to spend more and tax less. Depending on, they could err more towards spending or more on tax cuts, but depending on what side of the spectrum they're on. But in general, politicians have that pressure from their constituents. And one of the ways they try to, you know, square that, you know, cross a bridge over that divide is through persistent inflation, and basically say that the we're going to run structural deficits, and some of that's going to come out in the form of structural price increases.
So if everything should be getting cheaper because we're getting more productive, you can look at an assembly line for an automobile from 100 years ago to today. Obviously, it's more efficient, it's more automated, you know, robotics is incredible. all of these things, TVs as well, they, you know, that's getting so much more efficient. They can't even keep the price from going down. But if everything should be getting cheaper, but it is getting more expensive because we're expanding the money supply, the question is ultimately, why do they keep doing this? Why keep expanding the money supply? Is there some reason that they need to keep the money supply expanding? Is it because does that make the economy grow more? Does that actually lead to more prosperity? Why do this if it's making everything more expensive when it should be getting cheaper?
It's mainly because, well, there's a couple key reasons. One is that in this entire flexible ledger era, which going back to my earlier point of the big mismatch between transaction speeds and settlement speeds, someone gets to be in the middle and arbitrage that. And so they use fractional reserve banking. And one of the ways they kind of quote unquote fix issues at fractional reserve banking is to print more money. And so in order to kind of keep the system as they've currently structured it, it kind of requires an occasional burst of money supply growth, unfortunately, if they want to keep that system, which I don't think is a great idea, but that's the system that they've kind of designed and are comfortable with in this current technological era. And then the other one is, like I mentioned before, that they have these pressures of spending and taxing, and inflation, perpetual inflation. Even though it's unpopular for people, it's not necessarily as unpopular sometimes as a transparent tax increase. It also allows the cost to be somewhat deferred. An example I like to use is that when America polled people, should we go and do a war in Iraq? Over 70% of people said, yes, we should. Now, if you had said, okay, in 10 years later, there's going to be this much trillion, that's how much it's going to cost. And if we divide it per household, this is kind of the scary number that it's going to be. Would that number have been similar? Or put it another way, if they said, hey, should we invade Iraq? By the way, there'll be a 10% income tax to pay for that in real time. Would you still like to invade? The answer probably would have been quite different. And so basically, politicians do, on average, do their best to try to defer the cost of things they want to do, make them more opaque. And even if a well-meaning politician comes in and says, I'm not going to do that, in many cases, they don't stay in office very long because the voter public also want more spending and they want less taxes if they perceive it as benefiting them. So they say, well, this person is not meeting my goals. I want this other person. And then often they turn to those more opaque ways of doing it. So it's kind of like this gradual accumulated error in the system. I think a good analogy is if you leave your computer on for too long, it eventually starts accumulating little memory leaks, and just becomes gradually more efficient over time. The persistent fiat debasement is kind of that like memory leak in the system. It's kind of that error correction where they couldn't quite balance the books year after year after year. And so that's kind of this opaque transmission mechanism to pay for some of this stuff.
So to that point, then that's why we see the national debt just continue to increase and increase. And even the interest that we owe on that national debt is now comparable or perhaps even more than our annual military expenditure, which is quite large for the United States. And that's just the interest in the debt. A lot of people, you see people talking about, well, the debt doesn't actually matter. You know, we don't have to balance the budget. I guess the implicit assumption there is because we can just print money to cover the difference. But is that true? And I mean, what are the risks to this never balancing the budget, increasing the debt? How does this affect regular people? And does anything stop this?
So you're right. The way that they're able to kind of make that statement is the implicit thing is because we can print the difference. But the downside is that printing the difference negatively affects some people, particularly anyone holding cash, anyone holding bonds, basically the people that are holding parts of the fiat system or that have their income denominated in it. A thing I like to point out is that whenever you have a spending money supply, it benefits one side. Like every contract is now affected by government decisions that affect debasement. So everybody's wage, as well as different businesses that they have, if they have kind of multi-month or multi-year supply contracts with each other at certain prices, these are fixed things. And for example, if you're an employee and you get a certain wage and the money supply is growing every year, the burden is on the employee side to try to increase their wage every year, whereas the employer has the built-in advantage of the, you know, kind of the status quo. And especially with the, we talked about how there's a difference between money supply growth and CPI. So it's easier for the employer to point to CPI and say, well, maybe I'll give you that number. And so it kind of airs the power toward one side of a contract when this happens. And so that's the cost of debasement is that, if you were to steelman what they're thinking, they think that they often can deploy resources better than the private sector. And so if Marcus Aurelius is running the economy, maybe he's the if some outlier capital allocator is the one that happens to be debasing everyone's money and making decisions, then sure, maybe that one time out of 100 actually works out. The problem is that the vast majority of political systems are not going to be particularly efficient at capital allocation, that there's going to be some spectrum of error in the system. And then that's what leads to prices going up for everyday people.
Well, I appreciate the definition of the problem because I think it's hard to talk about a solution, as I said at the beginning, until we understand the problem. And I do want to transition a little bit to talking about what that solution might be. So you've been very vocal about Bitcoin. You've incorporated Bitcoin into your writings. You've gone on, I can't even count how many different podcasts and shows to talk about this as part of your kind of larger analysis and investment thesis. So do you view Bitcoin for the average person, for the individual or for the family, is this something that gives an escape hatch? Is this something that actually gives people a chance to get ahead, to get around this system where they're being pushed down all the time? They're not able to take that cheap debt that those financial elites can. Is this a meaningful escape hatch for the average person, for the average American, to try and break this cycle that they have no control over?
I think it's the best tool that's available. I don't think it's a silver bullet for every single thing. So, for example, that problem I mentioned with wages, if you earn X amount of dollars per year and money supply is growing at a certain rate, you may still have trouble with your employer getting the wage that you deserve to kind of keep up your share of the ledger. That's still a challenge, but at least it helps with the savings side of the problem, which is to say, if you're looking at things you could purchase, like a savings bond that's giving you interest rate below the money supply growth rate, or a savings account, or a very highly valued equity, or a very highly valued house, that's not immediately meeting your shelter needs, Bitcoin is a very powerful savings device. The fact that it has no long-term supply growth once it reaches its total number of units, and there's also and this is where it gets challenging because there is an early advantage, which is to say that right now you benefit not just from Bitcoin's qualities, but the fact that it's being recognized by the world for its qualities. So there's a gap between what this network, how cool this network is, basically, and the world kind of over time, because these things can take a generation or two to test its qualities, come to appreciate its qualities, and then for many people grow up with its qualities. So changing is always harder than just growing up and something exists. And so Bitcoin has to go through some maturation process. And if people are feeling disenfranchised, they tend to look a little bit more for non-traditional solutions. And the risk there is that they could fall into scams and other kind of false promises. And that's where I think Bitcoin really threads the needle, which is to say, this is the most powerful thing around. A lot of intelligent people have looked into it from a variety of different backgrounds and said this is actually a pretty powerful thing, and that it can help you as long as you, I think, approach it kind of humbly, and as long as you don't then push further into kind of things that end up actually being frauds and scams and things like that. So I think this is in the near term, I think it can help people individually. And then should it become large enough and should it become something that people just kind of naturally grow up with, I think it can affect things at a more macro level, for our children's generation and grandchildren's generation, hopefully.
One thing that I want to touch back on is you talked about Bitcoin as a savings mechanism. And I think when they hear about Bitcoin in the news, they see the price, going up or maybe going down. It tends to do a bit of both. it's often characterized as this speculative investment. Is that how, you know, is it both a speculative investment and a savings mechanism? Do you view it as more so a technology for savings? How should people think about this? You know, 21 million, that's all the Bitcoin there will ever be. They will be finally created by the year 2140 on a diminishing schedule. Is this just another speculative investment? And maybe there's another speculative investment that they'd be better suited for? Or do you view it differently? Is it something that's for saving? And how do you draw that distinction?
So I classify it as an emerging store of value. So it's an emerging savings technology. You know, if you were to say in 2011, so two years after it came out, is this savings technology? I would say at that point, it's very early. It's not been tested, you know, in many different scenarios yet. The legal status was very unclear. It's a very small, highly volatile network. But every year that goes by, and as the asset becomes more liquid, more widely distributed, tested under, you know, different conditions to see all the different ways that the network holds up against what life throws at it. As we're now like 16 years in, I think it has transitioned more toward savings technology as something that can be relied upon. And I still think it has a ways to go. That volatility can shake people out, and it does require more research and conviction than what we normally think of as a low-risk savings asset in order to get in. It takes some degree of unconventional thinking or willingness to think outside the box to, you know, be meaningfully interested in the network before the majority are. And so I think that's probably the best way to think of it, is that there's a spectrum that Bitcoin is going through. And as long as it continues to be successful at the things that it's doing, it moves that dial from early speculation, you know, statistically this probably won't work out, but maybe it will, to, hey, this thing has been functioning for 16 years. It has higher uptime than Fedwire. It's been the largest, most liquid, secure cryptocurrency for every one of those 16 years. That's not the same asset per se as it was, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16 years ago. And I think it'll, you know, as long as it keeps growing and solidifying, it'll be a different asset at year 25. That's how I approach it.
A lot of times people will have gotten into arguments about, is Bitcoin an inflation hedge or is it not an inflation hedge? Or is it a hedge against something else? Like, is it a hedge against just the monetary policy uncertainty of a group of unelected bankers who create policy at the Federal Reserve, and, you know, that policy comes down from on high and you're just left to deal with the consequences of their boom and bust cycles? How do you think about that? So is this an emerging store of value asset that is a hedge against inflation, against monetary policy shenanigans? How do you, you know, what kind of analogy do you draw for people for how they should think about what this is that they are putting their fiat dollars into and getting back out?
So a hedge generally has a pretty specific meaning in finance, which is something that pays off at the moment of a certain thing you're worried about happening. So for example, if you own the S&P 500, a hedge might be that you buy put options on the S&P 500 that pay off if the S&P 500 goes down. That's a very specific hedge. There are other hedges that are maybe not that specific, but they're still very high probability to pay you at the period of time of something you're concerned about happening, kind of like insurance. Bitcoin, I don't classify as a hedge per se, because there's multiple variables that go into its price. It doesn't have a very high correlation with consumer price inflation, especially because, you know, the way that the market works, when it sees consumer price inflation coming in higher than expected, their natural reaction is to say, well, the central bank is going to have to raise interest rates then. They're going to have to try to harden their money. So maybe I should sell some of these, you know, other types of assets, or my liabilities might be getting a little bit harder because they're going to raise interest rates. I wouldn't classify it as saying if you're worried about CPI inflation, you know, this year, Bitcoin is not necessarily going to be going up and down at the right times for you. I go back to that emerging store of value thing, which is to say that there's this network, it's the best in class at what it does, and it has a fixed number of units. In contrast, all these different fiat currencies in the world, of which there's over 100, all inflating in supply at different rates, and that Bitcoin protects you from that long-term monetary debasement if you're willing and able to withstand some degree of volatility along the way, because you're also dealing with the fact that the world is gradually understanding what this asset is. Another thing I like to point out is that in order to go from worth zero to worth trillions of dollars, Bitcoin needs upward volatility. And any upward volatility is going to attract speculators and people who buy it on leverage. And eventually that can get overdone for periods of time. And then unfortunately, you get downside volatility. So there's no realistic scenario where you get upside volatility that we want and that the network needs in order to get large enough without those periods of washout and downward volatility. And that's why it can seem like a speculative asset. I also think that there are certain assets that can seem speculative if you haven't researched all the properties. So years ago, people said, I think the big tech stocks are speculative. Well, if someone did a ton of work and said, I have a pretty sound thesis why I think that these things are going to get bigger than anyone thinks, that they're solving bigger problems than the average person seems to realize. And here's my reasoning, and I'm looking at their balance sheet and their fundamentals, and here's the price to earnings multiple I'm willing to pay, whatever research they do. You know, they're not really viewing it as a speculative decision unless they're leveraging it or you know, taking on too much risk with the thesis. And Bitcoin is similarly. I think that there are a lot of people that they haven't ever sent a Bitcoin transaction. They haven't really analyzed what are the network effects involved that can differentiate it from other assets. How does mining and nodes work? How does the network work in principle? Why is it different than a different cryptocurrency? What are the trade-offs if you change any of those variables? There are a lot of people that, for a variety of, you know, good reasons, haven't done the work on that. They're too busy being a doctor or a mom or a chef or any number of things that life throws at us. They just, like, I haven't, yeah, I can't tell you everything in my car how it works either, right? So there are a lot of people that just, for whatever reason, haven't done that. And there some subset of them will call it a speculation, which I think is generally not the case, other than, again, at the really early stages when, you know, there was a higher probability of failure, I think.
So for people who are, you know, they're wanting to get their feet wet a little bit in Bitcoin, maybe they're realizing that this game, this fiat system is a bit rigged against them. It's very difficult to try and get ahead, even though they're working very hard. How do you recommend that somebody actually does this? I mean, do you go all in with everything you have, everything you can spare right away? Are there other strategies out there that are more effective or more reasonable for the average person? And just to be able to also deal with that volatility, because it will go up and down in the short term. So what in your mind is the best strategy for the average person when it comes down to, okay, I want to start getting some Bitcoin, I want to start saving in Bitcoin, but how do I go, like, where do I start with this? How much do I buy? What do I do here?
There's a danger at buying too much that exceeds your conviction level or your volatility tolerance, because you're more willing to get shaken out of your position at a loss or, you know, during a big sell-off. And so I don't think it's right to kind of rush in more than you're comfortable with. I think initially, the pretty low hanging fruit is to get off zero. There's a lot of answers for, there's a lot of right answers for how much Bitcoin you should have. But I think that if anyone who looks into it generally finds that the zero is not one of the right answers. So I think get off zero. And then there's a couple steps you can make. You can experiment with it to some extent. You could buy some from an exchange or a brokerage and then pull it into your own self-custody and try sending a transaction with amounts that you're comfortable with, given the research, with like a simple mobile wallet, and you can graduate toward more secure options for larger amounts if you decide to go that route. You could also invest some time into reading a handful of Bitcoin-related books. It's not necessarily the first thing you want to do is, if you want to get them into Bitcoin, you don't necessarily shove them a 400-page Bitcoin book. But if someone, for example, watches this podcast or watches your series or is otherwise interested in the asset, I think the next step is to spend a weekend, read a couple high quality sources on it, so that you get more of the details than we can cover in a conversation like this. And then consider getting off zero. And generally, the more you learn, there's some research that shows basically the more someone is knowledgeable about Bitcoin, the larger share of the net worth it ends up being. So my general view is that if there's a time where it makes sense for you to increase your holdings substantially, I'm not the one that tells you that. You're the one that figures it out for yourself and decides that your level of understanding or comfort with the asset has increased, and therefore a larger position might be right for you.
I think that's great advice, because the last thing you want to do is get out over your skis, so to speak, when you don't yet understand exactly what you own and the power of this thing, and then end up seeing a big correction in the price and selling at a loss, and then feeling disenchanted and jaded and like this, you know, you somehow got screwed over here. I would always recommend to people too, you know, dollar cost averaging is a great way to do it. Buying a little bit every day or every week or every month, smoothing out that volatility. And I truly think of it as my savings technology, as you had said earlier. It's how I save for the future, for my family. And, you know, I'm curious too, because we're running up on time here. And one thing I wanted to ask you is just, is there one thing that you wish everyone, if whether they're, you know, a Bitcoin fan, or they're just thinking about Bitcoin, or they maybe that this is the first time that somehow they stumbled upon this show and they're just hearing about Bitcoin for the first time, what do you wish people understood about money today, about the system as it exists today, that maybe is not widely understood?
So I'll give two answers. Because one of them is kind of a repeat, but I'll rephrase it, is I think that the biggest thing to realize is that the baseline for price inflation is not zero. It's negative, because on average, we get more productive at things, not less productive. And therefore, the thing you always want to focus on, the question you want to ask with most financial assets is, what is my rate of dilution? If I'm holding dollars or any other currency, look up the long-term growth rate of that thing you're holding, offset by whatever interest rate you expect to get on that holding, and that's your net dilution. So if your money supply is growing up by 7% a year and you're getting a 4% interest rate, you're getting diluted by an average of 3% per year. Your share of the network, you know, aside from new income that you're actively working for, just your passive share of the network is shrinking. And it means someone else is growing, someone else is getting that. And so that's number one. And that applies for multiple things. That applies for, you know, if you're holding gold, your long-term dilution rate is somewhere around 1.5%, and you can look that up for yourself. If you're holding equities, sometimes they're issuing shares, sometimes they're buying back shares. You can also think of it in terms of you know, market share, you know, or other companies kind of taking market share from your company on average, or your kind of national stock index. And the same thing with real estate. If you own real estate, there's some degree of new growth, that like the new construction that's happening. And so your share of, you know, all houses that exist is shrinking, which can be a funny way of looking at it. But I think if you apply that lens to everything you could own as savings, that's a really important baseline. So CPI is not your target. Not getting diluted is one of your main targets. The second thing I'll say is actually about Bitcoin rather than the existing system. If people ask me one thing I wish they'd know that I don't see commonly mentioned, there's a natural tendency to assume in technology that new things displace old things, that anything newer is going to be just better in every variable than older things. So new computers generally better than an older computer, for example. Newer software is better than software from a while ago, with some exceptions. And so people naturally assume that, okay, Bitcoin is cool, but it's 16 years old. Why shouldn't I assume some of these newer ones are better? And my general answer to that is the main exception for that rule of newer technology being better is communication protocols. So things like Ethernet, that's 50 years old, we're still using Ethernet. USB, something like 30 years old, we're still using it. Simple mail transfer protocol, something like 45 years old, still going strong. Internet protocol is in the, so far in the age of the internet, the answer for how long a communication protocol lasts once it becomes dominant is indefinitely. We don't really know how long these things last, because they're going on decades with, and they're still just as strong as they ever were. And some of them gradually update over time. So Ethernet is faster than Ethernet from 20 years ago. USB 3.0 is faster than Ethernet 1.0. And what they have in common is that they achieve network effects, and they're by design, their purpose is simple. And things that change more rapidly are on the edges of the network or on higher layers of the network. And Bitcoin, I would generally argue, is that 16 years in, it's the dominant communication protocol for money. And it exhibits very similar dynamics, or similar you know, aspects to those other types of communication systems. And I generally think that's the right way to conceptualize it as a technology, not as something that keeps coming and disrupting the prior thing, but something that, you know, comes out, gets tested, wins whatever early dominance needs to win, achieves, you know, large market share, and then becomes a pretty persistent part of our digital lives.
Does that mean it's fair to say that for somebody who's still hesitant, maybe about Bitcoin, because they're feeling like I've missed the boat, I'm too late. Does that mean that they're still early in this development?
I think so, especially on a risk-adjusted basis. It's not as early as 2011, but it takes much less risk than it did in 2011. And one way to think of it is that the Bitcoin network is something like 0.2% of global assets. Gold is something like 2% of global assets, so about 10 times bigger. And all the other assets together, so savings accounts, bonds, real estate, and equities, and private businesses, that's the other 98%. And so one way to think of it is, you know, what is the total addressable market of a portable leading type of money with no long-term supply growth that you can self-custody yourself, or that you can send to anyone in the world in seconds or minutes, depending on what layer of the network you're using? You know, I think that's worth at least several percentage points of global assets. Some people have higher estimates, and they're not necessarily wrong. I think 0.2 is still early. I would advise people against unit bias. We look at it as 21 million Bitcoin, but it's actually 2.1 quadrillion units. In the actual code, that's the actual unit. It's just the underlying Satoshi unit that we call it now. Satoshis are still very cheap, and I think the network is still very small compared to what it could become and what it should become, as long as some core tenets of it keep working as expected.
Well, that's a heck of a pitch. If I wasn't already sold on Bitcoin, I think I would be again. Lynn, I want to thank you so much. And for anyone who wants to follow your work, you're at Lynn Alden Contact on X, primal.net/Lynn for those who want to find you on Nostr. And your website is lynnalden.com, where you have a newsletter. You have great resources for people who want to dive deeper. You have your book, Broken Money. You have many other podcast appearances as well, several on this show in even longer format. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated it. And thank you for sharing your knowledge.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for watching Saving in Bitcoin, your financial freedom blueprint on the Bitcoin podcast. Bitcoin is a return to savings, real savings built on sound money. Make Fold your personal finance hub and take control of your financial freedom. Buy, earn, and save in Bitcoin, all in one place.